Welcome, and thanks to everybody for coming. My name is Howard Rappaport, and I'm an alcoholic. We're here today to honor and remember our friend, Larry Klinger. In the past few years, we've lost several giants in these rooms. Among them, John Mullins, Jim Harp, Bill Roop, and now Larry. I'm going to be brief because we've got a lot of people that want to share. When I first came to AA, I remember looking at the steps, the promises, and listening to everybody talk about God and the higher power. Being Jewish, I immediately thought that I'd fallen into a religious cult. But it was Larry who took me aside and said that this was a spiritual program, not a religious program. And with that, I felt at ease. When I think of Larry, I will always remember Larry working with newcomers. To Larry, the newcomer was the most important person in the room. He always had a kind word of encouragement and direction for these people, suggestions. Larry never told anybody what to do. A lot of times he wouldn't even make a suggestion. He'd just tell you a story, and you were supposed to figure out what the story meant. He was very good at that, and he quizzed me several times. Today, we have, like I said, I'm going to be brief up here. I love Larry Klinger, but we have a lot of people that want to share about Larry Klinger. And just a brief announcement from here. This thing has been announced for the last 10 days, and the people that came up to me first are the people that were asked, were scheduled to speak. Don't want this thing to run all day, so, you know, we have to cut it at some point. So I will try to get other people who have come up to me and asked, but if I don't, please forgive me. It's simply a matter of time, not that you're not important. If there was a meeting going on at NAVA, you could almost, it was at least a 50-50 bet that Larry was here. I don't care what time it was, if it was 7:30 in the morning or if it was 8 o'clock at night. Larry went to all different kinds of meetings, and he was really, really a force and a presence in all those meetings. I've tried to get people from all the meetings that he went to come up here and share their remembrance of Larry. I think that's a fitting tribute to him. To start off, we're going to start with the earliest meeting, the 7:30 group, which is that's the early morning study group. From that group, and also from the 5:45 on Tuesdays and Fridays, we have Paul O. Come on up, Paul.
Hey, everybody. I'm Paul. I'm an alcoholic. I drove up here from Decatur in 10 minutes, praying for serenity the whole way while driving on the right-hand shoulder and cutting people off. Larry would have appreciated that, I think. I'm so grateful that we're all here, that we're doing this, and I wrote out some things. I may or may not read it, but I wanted to do honor to Larry by not just getting up here and spontaneously riffing, which, as he, I'm sure, would point out to me, I was very capable of doing at length and did with him many times. I want to celebrate, really, my life experiences that intersected with him. He was never my formal sponsor. But he was and still is my teacher in ways that it's kind of like a time release capsule. I'm just now becoming aware of all the different ways that Larry's influenced me. There are a few others. When I first came in 1991, there was Larry, there was Bill Roop, there was Colonel Tom from the 11 a.m. meeting. There was Beverly from that meeting, Maggie Harrison, George Brown. All staunch, had a reputation for being, you know, clear, tough old-timers. Every one of them, and starting with Larry, was so kind to me. They saw how broken I was, and Larry later told me, he said, you didn't need me to be tough with you. You needed me to just welcome you here. And he did that. So the things I noticed about him right away were his compassion, his clarity of thought, even if I didn't agree with what he was clearly thinking and presenting, it was clear. And his good humor. I mean, there was almost no subject that he wouldn't find something humorous about, sometimes to the consternation of many others around him. But hardly ever to my consternation. And he had this quality of speaking directly to people in a way they could understand. And I'm still striving for that. That's one of the ways. He's one of the people I think of when I'm trying to self-edit to be more clear and not be all tangential. And I think that's why so many newcomers to AA Whether they're highly educated with multiple degrees or, you know, grew up and got all their education on the streets, were so attracted to him. It was his clarity. And so people who came in fearing that they were like terminally and uniquely flawed, broken, their heads swimming with confusion, overwhelming thoughts of shame and remorse, he just cruised right through that stuff. He didn't give that stuff much countenance. He would just, they would encounter this plain-speaking, street-smart, irreverent, really ebullient presence who confronted, absolutely insisted on confronting pomposity, rigidity, and grimness, whether it was obvious to all of us or only to him, he was the only one who saw it, with real zest and joy. He delighted in doing that. What a relief that was for me, because I came in here so grim. I mean, the slogan, or the saying, where the program, like a loose garment, I wore it like a shrunken wetsuit. And Larry saw that, and he helped me a lot with that. So how many times did people, at first, I gasped at first, the first time I heard him sharing on the literature and directly, you know, person to person, disputing and correcting Bill Wilson. Oh, my God. You know, Larry's correcting Bill Wilson. And editing the book. I mean, he would change it on the fly. He would say, it should read like this. And so after a while, he helped me take Bill Wilson off the pedestal that I placed him on. Or he would do it by playing with the English language. I mean, before there was rapping and rhyming, Larry was doing all kinds of things with the English language. And for reasons that only he knew that I so enjoyed, because we all have our persona, the way we think we are or supposed to be. And this is not my favorite thing to realize about myself, but I can be a bit stiff and sort of uptight about myself and how I'm being perceived. So he decided my name wasn't Paul anymore. It was Paluchi Yamaguchi. And endless variations of that. I never knew what my name was going to be from him. Paluchi Yamaguchi, how's your Gucci? And I'd be like, what's that? So he would change it to suit the occasion, and it was this connection that we had. And he did it without breaking a sweat. It was effortless for him. He was a connector. And we both really relished it. We didn't see each other very often, which was okay with me, and I'm sure it was okay with him, too, though I never asked him. When we did, it was intense, it was personal, it was funny, and we didn't have to hang on to it, and I loved that. And when I stopped coming to the early morning study group every morning because I actually had this job where they expected me to be there like by 8 o'clock, and it was, you know, it took me 6 months of agonizing to realize I really should be at work. He was one of the founding members. I think he was the third or fourth member. He said, that's fine. We'll be fine without you, and you'll be fine without us, and then we'll see you on Saturday. And so all my agonizing were sort of boiled down by that one man's two sentences. And he was the only one of the founding members who did that. Some other ones had some dire predictions for my physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual sobriety. And being the former attorney I was, I pointed out theirs right back at them, even more so. But he also had this ability and desire to think about others outside of his own sphere of self-interest, even if for a moment, because we're, as a group, we tend to be sort of preoccupied with ourselves, if not blatantly selfish. With someone, How am I doing? What should I be doing? But he would think about others, which I think is one of the hallmarks of sobriety to me. After Steve C. and Wes A. formed, the first two members formed the early morning study group with a coffee pot, several resentments, not one, not two, but three, and a real zealous desire to return to fundamental AA. Not quite fundamentalist AA, but pretty darn fundamental. And permission from the Navajo Board of Directors, because it filled a hole in the schedule. I think Larry was the third or fourth member. He was a refugee from the 930 group like me, and I was maybe like the sixth member, 1 or 2 months after it started. And then when the meeting began growing over the next few months and years by word of mouth, and it's literature-based, and it was in a good time in the morning, we began to get into the open the curtain wars, which those who were there at the time know, the curtain wars were intense. But one thing about Larry, he had opinions, but he never sweated the small stuff. And to him, what was important, though he never campaigned for open the curtains, he was a, it's weird to describe him this way, but a quieter presence, at least about that topic. But he was all about what's pragmatic, what works. And he didn't campaign for it, but he was supportive. And when we finally opened the curtains, he had enough insight to personally advise me not to gloat, because he knows how I'm inclined. He took me aside and said, no gloating. I said, damn. You're not even my sponsor, and I'm still going to do what you're suggesting. I know it's only a suggestion. And then there was a time after the curtain wars when there was a certain amount of bad feeling when Larry and my actual sponsor, sitting here, David Newberry, who were sort of the group's elder statesman at that point, held it together, didn't take sides, listened or laughed when appropriate. And David intervened directly, and Larry soon afterwards, when I nearly got into a fist fight over the 10th tradition back there in that corner, with another guy named Steve, who was much bigger, much meaner, had failed anger management several times, would have killed me, and I found myself this paragon of sobriety, figuring out what thing can I break off that I can stick in his neck. So I can, and Larry was just like, you'll be fine. It'll be okay. It'll be okay, and I believe him. I believe him. Another gift I got from Larry is I had this dilemma at my new job early on. I got hired as a tech at the treatment center where I'd been, because I was hanging around there all the time anyway, and they said, we might as well pay you minimum wage plus 10 cents and, you know, put you to work, make you useful. And a little while after I'd done that, the powers that be decided, okay, everybody who works in this treatment center has to be absolutely addiction-free. So everybody has to quit smoking, no overeating, no nothing. And I was a smoker who was getting kind of tired of it at that point. I'd have to stop halfway up a flight of stairs, take some breaths, make it all the way up the flight of stairs, light a cigarette, you know, not making the connection that these two things were related. But I really wanted that job. And I desperately wanted that job, and I just decided I want to do this, and I want to apply to grad school to get a master's in social work so I can become a counselor and save tens, hundreds, thousands of lives. And I told Larry this stuff. I was sitting downstairs at NABA back when they served dinner 5 nights a week, and I was waiting for dinner to be ready. And I was just sitting there, you know, thinking all on my own, which is never a good look early on. It still isn't really now. But I was catastrophizing, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to quit. I'm going to lose this job. I'm not going to get into grad school. I'm not going to have a career as a counselor. So Larry sort of figured out something was going on. He sat down and said, how are things going? So 4 minutes later, when I paused for my first breath after telling him how things were going, he smiled and said, I have some ideas. Would you like to hear them? And by asking permission, Larry actually was masterfully practicing a clinical intervention that I had to go to grad school and extra training to learn called motivational interviewing, where he asked my permission to give an opinion. I gave it, and I was open to hearing it. He said, first thing, you don't have a lot of time invested in your career yet, so maybe you don't have to worry so much about losing it at this point. So, huh. Second, the best counselors I've seen don't actually have to save or fix anybody, really. They just listen and they model sobriety, whether they're in recovery or not. But if you need to figure out how to fix people, you know, maybe you could do that later. And I was like, Said, third, after you finish your dinner tonight, smoke your after-dinner cigarette, then crumble up the rest of the pack and throw it out. And tomorrow, claim this day today, this little tiny smidgen of a day, as your first full day of smoking sobriety. And so you'll be on day two. And then if you want one after that, just remind yourself that you're absolutely going to have one tomorrow, but don't remind yourself that tomorrow never comes. And he told me all this stuff, and I've been smoke-free ever since. Did go to grad school. Learned early on to not fix people, because I can't and I don't have to, but it's Larry's voice. I hear that, and a lot of times when I'm in a therapy session, I'll see him, Paluchi Yamaguchi, you're trying to fix someone again. You can't stop it. Okay, thank you. So I'm really grateful that I was asked to speak about my recovery life with Larry, because I tend to idealize people who I admire, and then I'm not a borderline personality disorder person, I don't think. I could if I really worked at it, but then when I see them being human, I then have to devalue them. Oh, they're off that pedestal. I've done it with sponsors. I never did it with Larry, who was thoroughly human, and anyone who knew him for more than a couple of minutes knows, and very fallible, very human. I've always seen, admired, and loved him as a strong presence of intellect, passion, and spirit that he is. not was, he is those things, and I'm going to continue honoring him completely as is, taking him as is. So Larry, I thank you, and I love you the way Bill Roop is probably telling you for the 48th time right now. I wish you well, and I thank his family for being the influence that they've been on him and for sharing him with us, and I thank all of you for letting me share and be with you.
Thank you, Paul. That was great. Next up, we have somebody that doesn't often attend meetings here. Occasionally he does, but he attends a lot of meetings. He's got long-term sobriety. He's a neighbor of Larry's, a friend of mine, friend of Larry's, and someone that told me that he had known Larry since he was a small child, which being that he's the same age as I am, that makes it a very, very long time, very long time. So, Marnie, would you come up, please?
Hello. It's a tough act to follow. I've just known Larry a very long time. I mean, there was a gap in there. When I was about 3 or 4 years old, he was the seltzer man. And he used to deliver to my mother, you know, and they would come and they would smoke. She didn't drink, and he didn't drink there, and they would smoke and talk about whatever, you know, politics or situations. And so I've always had a connection with him. Like I told Myrna that I've known Larry longer than she has. And you were married 57 years, right? Right. So, he like what Paul was saying, that he really did just cut to the chase, and he was real clear. He taught me, like the way he practiced his Judaism. I used to call it, he was a reconformadox. And basically, he just cut through all the dogma and practiced the spiritual meaning behind all the observances. And he carried that over to his recovery. I didn't, know him and he was using, but I was talking to a friend of mine who was, when Larry was in the pizza business, and he was his supplier. He said that Larry never drank out of a glass. They just passed the bottle around. And it's kind of like, that's sort of a metaphor for the way he lived his life. You know, he just got to it. And like everyone else was saying, that man before me and people that know him, that he really was always about what he was like, not trying to look good. He wanted to get it right, and he would go and he would just cut right to it. And he didn't really need all the credit for doing it. And that was a great thing. And then it was just really an amazing thing that when I moved into my house, that also I see him sitting on his chair across the street, directing the guy doing his yard work. And that's just who he was to me. And I don't know if those of you that were at the cemetery when the rabbi gave the eulogy, and was saying how that Larry was really instrumental in establishing, it's called Jack's, it's a Jewish alcoholic, chemically dependent, significant others, like, cover everything. That's kind of been Larry, just roll it all in, because it's all some form of addiction of some kind. And because at that time, it was people, I guess it's, no matter what your, religion was, the people kept it on the down low. They didn't really want to admit that they had a problem. And he made it accessible for a lot of people that otherwise wouldn't have gotten any help. And so, like, a lot of people are benefiting from his efforts. And he never tried to take any credit for anything. He was just there. And I would go over and we would sit and talk. And I enjoyed that a lot. And it really was a connection to my parents and my childhood, just having him around. And it was really very consoling for me. And, and he and Myrna have become family to me. And I just am grateful to be here. And I just want to leave some time for some other people. Thank you.
Thank you, Marnie. Next, from the I Can't, We Can 9:30 morning meeting, we have a young lady that's a staple there. She's always there. And when I used to come to the 11 o'clock meeting, I'd get here about a half an hour early, and their meeting was just letting out, and I could always see Larry sitting in that room. And I just knew Larry was going to be there. He'd been there for that meeting, and that he would be there for the 11 o'clock meeting. So I'd like to call up Julianne, please.
Thank you, Howard. I am Julie. And I also happen to be an alcoholic. How convenient. Paul, wow, Paul made me think of like about 100 other things I wish I had thought about before this afternoon. And one of them was, talking to Larry was a lot like talking to Dr. Seuss. You're absolutely right. It was like, a lot of way with the rhyming stuff. He was good with it. I haven't known Larry as long as everybody else has, but I do know one thing. It's very hard to talk about Larry Klinger without saying Larry Klinger. For some reason, he's never gone Larry. And if you're one of the guys, you call him Klinger. But so I had to call him the Larry Klinger. So I don't know. There's really only one Larry, but there's definitely only one Larry Klinger. And that's how I feel about him. He was here when I got here, and I guess I first really got to know him when I was going to the 7:30 meeting. But I didn't do that for very long, and I ended up mostly at the 9:30. And he basically kind of came back to the 9:30 after a while. And his presence there, for me, was always just a lot of fun, because I knew that he was an elder statesman, and I knew that he was going to tell it like it was. And that he didn't particularly care what everybody else thought, but that he really, really respected your right to think whatever you wanted to think and to believe whatever you wanted to believe. And he closely defended your right to say whatever you wanted to say and his right to say whatever he wanted to say. And he defended your right to be wrong and his right to be wrong. And there's just something about that. And he did it with grace and dignity without making you feel small, if you were, because there is no right or wrong in AA. And we thought, got to come here and stay here for a long time to figure that out. But one of the things that he, I think, was an accomplishment of his that he was extremely proud of, and that is that he did believe there was a definitive answer about crosstalk. And if you ever got into it with him, he was so sure of it that he wrote to the central office for the definitive answer about crosstalk, and he got it. I don't know how long ago it was, but he will talk about it all the time, and I do think that the 9:30 is the only group that still has a copy of what he was sent from the central office. And this is the copy. So I will gladly show it to you, but I will not give it to you because I feel like an archivist now that Larry does. And Larry didn't even have his own copy anymore. And he came to a meeting, and we... How many times have you got another group conscience about crosstalk? And I'm like sitting back there laughing and crusty, that's so stupid about crosstalk. There is no such thing as crosstalk. I can prove it. You're like, prove it. So I wrote to the central office and I got the answer right here. Because I can't find it. I said, I think that's in our notebook. And I went through and I said, you're responsible for this. So if anybody thinks the answer is no, there is no such thing as crosstalk. And Larry didn't think so either. Which is what made his meetings, being in a meeting with him, so much fun. But there's that. And then there's what I think is most important to me, because it was the way he taught me this lesson, is how he interpreted the first tradition for me. That our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. He understood this paradox that we have, that our individual recoveries were what unify us, and that there was no right or wrong way to go about it, that each individual together was the unity. And it's difficult to explain, and you have to stick around and watch a lot of people recover in a lot of different ways to really understand it. But he was fiercely defensive of your right to recover the way you needed to recover, as long as you stayed within a few boundaries, which is don't drink, right? And it was just no irony to me that the day after he died in the 9:30 meeting, we were on tradition one, and I thought, well, thank you, Larry, here you are. Because he, to me, really epitomized your right to do, to say and feel what you want, you know, about this program. As an individual, you know, he was just a fascinating man, and it was just fun to be in a meeting with because you did not know what he was going to, how he was going to interpret what was being spoken about. And one of my favorite memories is that he talks about in the big book where Ebby says, Bill questions Ebby and says, you know, what happened to you? And he said, I got religion. And I always say in the meeting, you know, I'm really glad you guys didn't say that to me, you know, because I would have run out. I didn't want religion. I came here for religion. But he says he thinks that what he really meant by that was that old saying up in New York, when something good happened to somebody, he said, how'd you come about that? He said, I got religion. Like, it's a saying, apparently, in New York. And I've been thinking about, I wonder if he's right about that, you know? That has nothing to do with religion, and all these people think it does. But I don't know if it does or not, but it really makes me think about that part of the book. He may be right, but that's to Paul's point. He'd like to rewrite the book and tell you it meant certain things that it probably didn't mean at all. Which is why I kind of laugh about big book studies, and everybody saying there's a right way and a wrong way to do a big book study. I think Bill and everybody would be laughing their butts off at us, I think, more than anything. But Larry, to me, was perfectly imperfect, and I really enjoyed that part about him. And I am very grateful that I knew him and that he influenced me and taught me the things that he did about the program. And I thank Howard for asking me to come up here and speak. But basically, more than anything, I just want to thank Larry Klinger for his personal recovery, which helped make mine possible. Thank you, Tom.
Moving from the 9:30, we go to the 11 o'clock Bridge Builders, which is my home group, and which shows you it can or cannot work. But anyway... from that meeting, we have Corey that has some kind things to say about Larry. Corey, come on up.
Man. I'm Corey, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. I tell you, when I got the call from Howard, my thoughts were, man, there must be someone else who knew him a lot longer and who has some better stories, probably who's funny, and all of those things. But my memories of Larry did not write a script or anything. But I moved here after about 14 years of sobriety. And to me, that was a daunting task. I had a network, and I was really involved in AA where I got sober. And moving here, I'm thinking, man, I have to start all over again, build a new network, and all of those things, which I really did not want to do. I knew I had to go to meetings, and one of my first meetings here at NAVA was the 1:30. In the little small room over there. And Larry was one of the characters that I remember from that room. I remember sharing that I was new to the city and that I'm an alcoholic and all of these things that I had going on with the job and moving here and all of that. And Larry, in his own little way, came up to me after the meeting and just talked to me. And he gave me some personal time and some personal attention like only Larry could. I left there thinking, now, what did he just say? And I'm thinking, that probably meant something, but I'm not quite sure what right now. But it definitely had a lot to do with staying sober, and he shared his own personal experience. And I remember being at the cemetery, and I remember seeing the obit in the paper. And I was thinking, you know, in the obit in the paper, it talks about how he was there for hundreds of alcoholics. And I listened to you guys tell the stories about Larry, and he just, I thought that I was the only one. He just had a way of making you feel special. You know, that smile, that look that he gave me when he talked, he was just like, you know, you are the man. And you are important, and, you know, just come on in here and grab your seat. There are no requirements. You are welcome, just like anyone else. And that was the bridge to my recovery here in Atlanta. He was one of the first people who just reached out and said, just come on in, sit down. We don't care anything about your past, your present, or your future. You meet the qualifications. And he did that in his own little way. And one thing that I remember about Larry is when he talked, I would kind of cringe and grab my seat because I never knew what was going to come out of his mouth. I'm like, okay, here we go again. But it was always something helpful, and it was always something that came from a genuine place of love. And you know, I know he's listening right now. And Larry, I just want to say, you know, thank you. Though you did, you tricked me because I thought I was special. But sitting in this room, I realize now that you were just being the loving Larry that you are. And he's such a gift to me and my sobriety. And thanks again for the opportunity, Howard.
Wow, we've heard from some really good people. This man can't time down any one meeting because he's generally at every meeting or as many as he can possibly make while still holding down a full-time job. And although his main job, and he'll tell you this himself, is to help alcoholics and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. He's been a force here for a long time. I believe he came in 1 year after Larry came in. So he's been here for 30-some-odd years. With that, I give you Rusty Jones.
I'm Rusty Jones, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And Larry was here at NABA when I first arrived in 82. And Larry and I had our disagreements. And if we go back that far, we were not well enough to disagree without being disagreeable. And Larry's one of the people that I remember who taught me that I could just disagree and not have to be disagreeable. And that's a critical lesson that Larry, there's precious few people still here that were here then. And I'll miss Larry. I'll miss them. Larry was one of the most authentic people I've ever met. The same Larry at the 7:30, the 9:30, the 11, the 5:45, and anywhere. We all knew the same Larry. And I remember a lot that I learned that I didn't agree. Larry and Roland didn't agree. There were things they didn't agree on, and it was interesting being a part of that. I normally sided with Roland, who was my grand sponsor, I learned so much from Larry, but the real lesson I carry with me, and hope I always will, is that I don't have to be disagreeable. We're gonna disagree from time to time, but it's such a critical lesson, and that's what I remember clearest. But there's so much more about the man. The newcomer was the most important person to Larry, and Larry reached me when I was new. And Larry was one of those good listeners. Good listening listeners are rare in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, as they are everywhere else. So, thank you, Larry. Love you, Larry. Larry will be with us for a long, long time to come. Larry joins those great names that will float around these rooms for. He's with us in the spirit and will be for quite a while longer. Larry's one of those people that have a special impact that outlasts us all. Thank you.
We're going to switch it up a little bit now. I'm not going to call from any particular meeting. But next up, we have a gentleman who was a sponsee of Larry's. He was a business partner of Larry's. He also attends the early morning study group, and he was kind enough to furnish us with this fine photo of Larry. So with that, I'd like to call up Thomas.
Tom Nerney, and I'm Irish, therefore I am weeping, but I won't weep. I am an alcoholic, and Larry was something very, very special to me, as he was to everyone. And that's what I love about this gathering, is that each one of us has something that we remember special about him, like Corey said. You know, that ability of him to get to you. And when I came in here, I was 54 years old, and Larry said, well, I was 52. And I said, well, that means I was out there longer than you. He says, yeah, but I was a lot worse than you were. And from his presence, when I first came in here, I was living in a halfway house. I was going to every meeting that NAVA had, and I kept seeing this guy. You know, he'd pop up. He was Mr. NAVA, you know, and I didn't know the difference between NAVA and whatever. And I did a lot of things very dutifully, and I got myself a sponsor. And my sponsor and I didn't exactly see eye to eye. And one Saturday, my sponsor and I were sitting knee to knee, and then we're nose to nose. And my sponsor had his finger in my face, and I was about ready to bite it off because I was an angry man in those days. And I said, you're fired. And Larry was sitting back at the windows like this. And in anger, I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, sure. And, you know, I think of him as he holds many titles. He was a husband. He was a father. He was a sponsor. He was a friend. But the phrase that comes to me is that he was a teacher. And he was a man of the book, which I think I'd like to just read a short passage. And this is from the book of Proverbs. And, you know, it's one of our shared common pieces of literature, just like the AA. And that was one of the things he talked about was ours, not mine, ours. And in Proverbs, he says, happy is the man that finds wisdom, and the man that obtains understanding. For the value of it is better than the value of silver, and the gain thereof of fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things that can desire are not to be compared to her. The length of days is in her right hand, and in her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those that hold her. And happy is everyone that holds her fast. I went into a business relationship with Larry. So I didn't have to worry about going and finding him at a meeting because I saw him 7 days a week. I lived in the warehouse of the business that we ran. I drove his truck. I did his bidding. I picked people up when he told me, bring them to this meeting or take this there. So I had the good fortune of seeing him not only as a member of AA, but as a member of the Atlanta community, as a businessman. And one of the things he taught me there was the beauty of honesty. You know, we were in it for the business. We were in it for the money. But I would see him actually suggest to people who wanted to buy things that they should save their money and buy it elsewhere. Or they didn't need that. Perhaps they could do this. And I said, what are you doing, Larry? You know, they were ready to buy an entire kitchen. He said, look, they'll be back. He says, let them buy what they need right now. He says, they won't be broke and they'll come back. And do you know that I was getting calls 8 years later from people who were looking for Larry Klinger to sell them equipment? There's also a Klinger trading company in town, founded by Larry Klinger, proprietor, and it used to be over near the Atlanta Water Works, and it's in business up in Dollarville right now, Klinger Trading Post. And the first time I went up there to buy something, there was a sign that said, Larry Red Klinger, proprietor. It's owned by a Korean family right now. Kim Klinger? I don't know. It's one of those things. But it goes to that other thing that he was, and that was he was a man of many parts. He was a combat veteran of Korea. I'm a combat veteran of Vietnam. He was a man who taught me that there was great joy. Don't sweat the small stuff. Don't worry about the things that are not important, but really focus on the things that were important. He taught me empathy, and we've heard about this. He listened to people. He didn't hear what he wanted to hear. He heard what the person was saying. And if he disagreed with it, he would do that. He would call BS on a person, but he would never dishonor the person who was saying that. That was the beauty, is that his empathy for others was so rich. You know, the people who worked in his yard, he didn't need to have them raking for the 500th time. He was giving them a daily wage so that they could regain their dignity. All right. That's what Larry was good at, was the old switcheroo, you know, hey, try him out with this thing and try that thing. And I had the good fortune of going to graduate school in New York, and I lived in Manhattan for 5 years. So when I met Larry, I knew enough Yiddish because I ran with a group of people up there. I was the only Gentile within this group, and my Yiddish got very good. I was the house boy. You know, they turn to me and say, well, what do Gentiles think? And I go, I don't know a Gentile. This Gentile thinks this. And that was part of what he taught me, was that sense of humor, that rough sense of humor. And as a young man, he used to raise pigeons on the roof. And he'd sit back there and he'd say, there's another pigeon. He'd look at the people who were in the room. He'd say, who was that new guy who came here this morning? I go, I don't know. He says, you know, he's here. And he would bring those people and invite them in and say, come on back here. I mean, he was fantastic. And that humility, you know, wear this program like a loose garment. Don't constrain yourself with all these rules and regulations. And yet he lived the principles. I mean, he had a personality as big as Manhattan, as big as all the boroughs, but it was his sticking to the principles that taught me so very, very much. You know, he did teach languages. He taught Yiddish. A lot of people don't realize that. There were more people running around with Yiddish swear words. They didn't know what they were saying, but they were saying them. And I won't repeat it here. And he also taught Hebrew. Because he had people who had been in jail from Columbus who didn't know what in the world they were saying Baruch Hashem, because they had heard Larry say it, and they knew that that was a beautiful thing to say. And all I could say was, Amen. He spoke from the heart. That was the language of Larry. So I agree with everyone who has stood up here and said that he was a unique man. And I missed him, because I'd go over to his house either to get chewed out for not doing something or visit, and he and Myrna and I would sit around and we'd have a cup of coffee, and those were beautiful moments. And that's when I think I learned most from him. So, you know, he's my teacher, and I think he's taught an awful lot of other people. But this picture, when I first saw it in small size, it looked like he was kind of grimacing at somebody. But then when I blew it up, look at the twinkle in his eye. He's waiting to get somebody's goat. He's waiting to nail someone. And when that thing came up and I saw that, you know, here he was, I could only hear him saying, "Keep it short, kid. Get off the damn podium and let somebody else talk. Thank you very much."
Thank you, Tom. The room we're in is part of the building at NABBA, and Larry was a very important member of NABBA and a very important person here. So I think it's very fitting that our president of NABBA, who is also a former sponsee of Larry, shares. So with that, I'd like to call Mike up. Thank you.
Oh, hello. I'm Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. And you know, I haven't had opportunity to grieve yet, and I'm starting to tear up a lot. All right, thank you for sharing him with us. You and he were the example of a sober relationship for my wife and I. Thank you so much. Larry was quite a character, you all know. You know, he could be very, very rebellious, you know, which was part of his mark, but I think a lot of that rebellion had to do with showing people that there was more than one way to do things. There was more than one way to become sober. Like was mentioned, the loose garment of AA. That's what he professed. Also, he liked to really put the jab and joke out there. You know, one morning after the 7:30, we were sitting talking, and the 9 o'clock meeting was coming in, the Al-Anon meeting. And they came up to Larry and they said, "Larry, we haven't seen you for a while." And he goes, "Ah, I solved my problem." They said, "What?" He goes, "I killed my partner." You know, and it shocked the stew out of me, what he said. But, you know, I had a sponsor who was a sponsee of Larry's. And I found out he was going to Larry all the time to ask him what to do. So I finally took the middleman out, went straight to Larry. And Larry said, "Yes, I'll be your sponsor, but I'll also be your friend." You know, and that's the way he's been for me, a friend. He told me he came in when he was 51 because I was 51 when I came in, so I'm 252. You know, and he said, "Yes, I'll do that, but I'll also be your friend." Just what a great friend. And I think of this building, and this is very short because, like I said, I keep trying to burst out in tears here. This building is a physical building, but there's also another dimension here. You know, there's a spiritual dimension here. People like Larry were the battery for that dimension. And I think the miracles that happened here on a daily basis charge that up, keep it going. In fact, I love coming in this building and sitting by myself before anything happens and just feeling it. You know? And Larry's here, and he always will be here. Thank you so much.
Larry's niece, Joe, had read a poem at the funeral, and with your permission, she'd like to read it again, please. Come on up.
Hi, I'm Joe. I'm proud to be here. And I just would like to say I have a sponsor in Smyrna, but Larry was my sponsor too. And I didn't have to ask him to be. He just jumped right in. Anyway, I'd like to read the poem that I wrote for my uncle. Born and bred in Brooklyn, New York, a brother, two sisters, the youngest of four. Losing both parents had set the stage. He came to Atlanta despite his young age. A born entrepreneur, but done so much more. The You Mix It man traveled door to door. He captured the attention of a bright young lass and made her forget all bows from her past. She was at a dance with a friend, he with his date. A broken down car would soon set their fate. 15 miles later, whether by chance or by choice, changed their lives forever, and we now rejoice. For they fell in love, it began on the spot. In 1957, they tied the knot. God blessed them with two incredible sons. Later on, five grandchildren would eventually come. Shooting pool was fun at Larry's place. His innate sense of humor brought smiles to each face. Pizza on call, a pizza lover's dream. When it came to pizza, the original supreme. From the finished product to pizza supplies, if this cuisine was your passion, Larry was your guide. From the crust of the pizza to pots and pans, he sold to our favorite places and quite little stands. Vic Wholesale came later. Things were never the same when Big Red and his truck won all the acclaim. He had been known to party at times with a crew, entertaining his friends while pursuing a brew. But as time went on, his partying ceased. As his interests changed, his passions increased. He began to garden, watching things grow, always staying abreast of Fox's latest TV shows. Latest news show. His willingness to help others along life's way is just one of the reasons we honor Larry today. No one's smile could brighten a room as much as my Uncle Larry's with his humorous touch. His laughter never fails to fill up the room, a ray of pure sunshine, no more doom or gloom. We all thank you, Larry, for being yourself and for the countless other things we could say. Just wanted to let you know how much you are loved on this occasion, your special day. Thank you.
Larry's lovely bride, Myrna Klinger, is going to share next. But, Myrna, we're going to bring a microphone to you so you don't have to come up here, okay? While we're waiting for that, I would like to thank Tim for doing the audio. I would like to thank Jay for setting up the rooms. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Myrna, and I'm a black belt Al-Anon. It was my privilege to be married to Larry Klinger for 56 years. I loved him from the first time I met him until today. He filled my life with love and joy and laughter. He gave me two beautiful sons. He helped everyone he could without judging them. A nurse at the hospital said that people like Larry who reach out to other people do not leave when they die. I know he will be in my heart and mind forever. I thank you for having this memorial service for him and for helping him maintain his sobriety. He loved AA and all of you. He saw it as his mission in life to help others get and stay sober. To my mind, he accomplished his mission. I would like to read an email from one of his sponsees. This is typical of phone calls, cards, and messages that I have received from as far away as Israel. This is a young man that Larry sponsored for 31 years. And we were at his graduation from Emory when he got his master's degree in public health. He went all over the world setting up hospitals for CDC. And while he was in Tibet, he adopted two children. He never married, but he reared the two children, and one of them is graduating from Emory in May. So you see how the ripples just go out. His dear Myrna, when Larry's name came up on my cell phone screen last night, I knew we had lost him. Thank you for thinking of me and letting me know so quickly. My son was in the next room when you called and came to me after we hung up. He sat on the bed next to me and said he was glad he met Larry and you at the dinner at my house. He knew Larry was my only AA sponsor for 31 years, and he had a good idea of how much Larry meant to my recovery. He gave me a hug and asked if I was okay. I smiled and told him that Larry's passing was not a shock, given his deteriorating health in the past months. I said that Larry was one of the most important people in my entire life, and that losing him would be a severe loss, no doubt. But what I feel now and have for years is a deep sense of gratitude to Big Red for helping me believe that I could not only get and stay sober, but that I could lead a happy and useful life. The blessings in my life are beyond counting. I am a free man living a happy and useful life. What an amazing gift. Larry Klinger was my model and guide in learning to live and engage in freedom and happiness. And for that and his friendship, I will be forever grateful. I look forward to seeing you when I come down for my daughter's graduation from Emory in May and the graduation and engagement party. I will send you details on the date and location. Please call me if you ever need me. Love, Dennis. So, and also, Dennis called me and I told him if he went online, he could hear the eulogy, the audio of it. And, so, anyway, he went online and heard it, and then he sent me this email. I did listen to Larry's eulogy this morning. I think the rabbi set the tone and mood of the funeral just right. Without emotionalism, he warmly described almost all of Larry's character. One of the most important, however, I must have missed. Humility, an important key of Larry's ability to help and influence people on the road to recovery and better lives, was his humility. In all the years I knew him, I never ever heard him tell anyone what to do. Never gave instructions if this is the way or that is the way. Instead, in the very best tradition of AA, Larry always shared his experience, strength, and hope. He described what he did, not what someone else should do. He inspired and motivated by trusting others to make their own choices and decisions. I hope you continue to enjoy the love and comfort of so many friends and family that are with you now. Lots of love from the Big Apple, Dennis. I don't want to imply that everything was rosy. Of course not. But the good far, far outweighed the bad. Larry taught me that one who does the loving is the lucky one. By example, he also taught me not to be afraid of life or death, because he lived life on life's terms and was fiercely independent. One of the last images I have of him is his trying to balance while walking so as not to have to use a walker or a cane. He suffered greatly at the end, and I'm glad he is no longer suffering. Larry lost his mother when he was 13 and his father when he was 19. He moved south from Brooklyn to live with his sister in Chattanooga until after he returned from the Korean War, when he moved to Atlanta. I'll just tell you one story about our courtship. So, everybody knew Larry was a little rough around the edges. He didn't have parents to guide him. And so we were dating for a little while, and the first gift he gave me was a sweater, and it was beautiful. It was turquoise sweater and lamb's wool. And my mother said, "You can't keep it." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because you're not engaged and you're not married, and a gentleman doesn't give a lady an article of clothing." So I cried and carried on. She let me keep it. But then she said, see, he didn't put a card in there, which means he doesn't want to state his intention. So I just said, Larry, next time you give me something, put a card in it. So he was proud of his Judaism and was involved in helping our rabbi teach other rabbis in Atlanta that contrary to a previous belief, Jews could become alcoholic and be addicted to other substances. The rabbi said at his funeral that Larry was larger than life, and for me that is certainly true. Thank you so much for having this wonderful tribute to him.
Thank you, Myrna. That was really special. Well, you see how many people came here today to honor Larry and how many people love Larry, and I certainly was one of them. But I want you to know, everyone that was asked to speak replied with the exact same answer. I'd be honored. Not just don't make me do it or anything like that. No, it was I'd be honored to say a few words about Larry. We've run out of time, so in closing, I just want to say that when I was a young man, my father told me, when you're gone, if people can say you were a good man, then you will have been a success in life. Larry Klinger was a very good man. True success in life and in these rooms. I'd like to thank everyone for coming. Thank you so much.